From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Alexander Heyman is a Bosnian writer who was visiting the U.S. when his city of Sarajevo came under siege. He stayed in the U.S. and became obsessive about learning to write in English. He succeeded. His new collection of short stories is getting rave reviews. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about how he learned to think and write in a new language. Also, we talk to political reporter Wayne Barrett about his new investigative biography of Rudolph Giuliani, the New York City mayor who recently dropped out of the Senate race after being diagnosed with prostate cancer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. The White House says substantive issues were on the table today at the Middle East summit at Camp David. President Clinton, Israeli Prime Minister Barak, and Palestinian leader Arafat are still operating under a news blackout, so we don't know what issues were discussed. But White House spokesman Joe Lockhart says President Clinton is taking part.
The president's role is trying to serve as an honest broker here and to do whatever he believes is constructive towards reaching an agreement. As far as the amount of time he spent with them, if you look at the last 2 days, I think he spent a large amount of time with the two leaders. Yesterday, he shuttled back and forth.
Earlier today, bowing to U.S. pressure, the Israelis said they canceled a military sale to China. An Israeli spokesman said the move is an attempt to stay on the Americans' good side in hopes of getting help on a Mideast peace agreement. Nearly 24 hours after an explosion in a 19th-century row house in Brooklyn, rescue workers are still digging through the debris. They removed the body of the building's elderly owner, but continue to search for two others. From member station WNYC, Richard Hake reports.
Heavy bricks, wood, furniture, and clothing have to be moved by hand as firefighters continue to hope someone could still be alive, although officials concede that's doubtful. Personal items like photographs litter the quiet tree-lined street. The four-story residential building in Brooklyn's historic Borough Hill neighborhood exploded, leaving a debris field 1.5 stories high, as well as extensive damage to an adjoining home, which later had to be knocked down to protect rescue workers. It's still unclear what caused the blast. Investigators have to get into the building's basement to determine the cause. Many residents reported the odor of gas, including the victims, just before the blast. They apparently asked a neighbor to check their home. The three entered the building, and minutes later, it exploded. For NPR News, I'm Richard Hake in Brooklyn, New York.
The German Protestant Church admitted today it used slave labor during the Second World War. Germany's Central Protestant Authority promises to pay a victim's compensation fund. Guy Raz reports from Berlin.
The German Protestant Church acknowledged that at least 26 parishes helped set up a labor camp in central Berlin during the Second World War. About 100 slave laborers, mostly Russians and Eastern Europeans, were forced to work in church graveyards. Protestant leaders said that a shortage of German workers compelled the church to take advantage of slave labor. The church leaders also revealed that some Catholic parishes were involved in using forced laborers. Protestant clergy urged the Catholic Church to also admit its wartime involvement with forced labor. A spokesman for the Catholic Church said it had no plans to contribute to the compensation fund. Last week, the German parliament approved a $5 billion package to compensate those who were forced to work in Germany during the war. For NPR News, I'm Guy Raz in Berlin.
On Wall Street, the Dow was up 57, the Nasdaq up 143. This is NPR News. Vice President Al Gore was the featured speaker today at the annual convention of the NAACP, where he lashed out at Republicans. From Baltimore, NPR's Philip Martin reports.
To thunderous applause, Gore criticized what he called a do-nothing Republican Congress, and he also took aim at his GOP rival, George Bush, who spoke to the group on Monday. Gore told the delegates that, unlike others, he has always stood with them and would continue to fight on their behalf.
Talk doesn't cost much. The true test is standing up to those who say they want to eliminate affirmative action. I will defend affirmative action because it is still needed in this country.
Gore also told the 4,000 NAACP delegates that he would support strong hate crimes and gun legislation and would oppose privatizing Social Security. President Clinton will address the gathering tomorrow. Philip Martin, NPR News, Baltimore.
George W. Bush says the presidential race is going to be a hard and close one, and he's taking nothing for granted. But he told state Republican Party leaders meeting in Texas that he feels great about his chances in every state. He joked that President Clinton must be worried because he spends so much time talking about the Republican campaign. Bush also accused Democratic rival Al Gore of shifting around a lot. A new study says a spermicide that was long thought to decrease the risk of a woman's getting AIDS may actually increase the risk. Research on the spermicide was presented at the World AIDS Conference in South Africa. After 2 years of delays, the Russian-built Space Service Module is on its way to the International Space Station. The module includes living quarters for the crews that will be used on the station. I'm Frank Stachow, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday marked the fifth anniversary of the largest massacre in Europe since World War II, the massacre in Srebrenica. My guest, Alexander Heyman, is a Bosnian writer who narrowly averted the Bosnian War. He was in the U.S. on a journalist exchange program 8 years ago. The day he was scheduled to return home, his city, Sarajevo, came under siege. Heyman stayed in the U.S. and became obsessed with learning English. He gave himself 5 years to write a story in English and have it published. Now, 8 years later, he has a book of stories written in English, published by Doubleday, that is receiving rave reviews. It's called The Question of Bruno. Critics Sven Burkerts wrote in Esquire, as vivid prose as you will find anywhere this year and as heartbreaking. In Entertainment Weekly, the book was praised for its piercing cultural observations. Alexander Heyman says he made up his mind to stay in the U.S. even before the siege of Sarajevo. I asked him why.
Why did I want to stay? Because I wanted to live. And I guess I was not brave enough to go back.
So even before the siege, you knew that there'd be trouble?
Yeah. I was a journalist. This is the strange thing. I knew everything I needed to know that there would be a war and it would be the way it was. But on the other hand, emotionally, I could not face up to that fact, and none of us could. We simply stared the facts into the face and would not see them. And that's one of the things that I thought about a lot too. And I realized that it is kind of the same mechanism that I believe human beings have, which prevents them from being able to imagine their own death. Because if we were able to imagine our own death, we would be paralyzed with fear of that. And most of the people outside of the small group of people who were actually organizing the crime could not see what was going on because it was too big. It was so much bigger than our lives that we could not see what was going on.
Before you were able to write in English, you took a lot of odd jobs. In the United States. Why don't you run through a list of some of the jobs you had in your first few years here?
Well, first, there were a few illegal jobs. I hope no one from the INS is listening to this. I served food in some place. I worked for a real estate agent who paid me less than a minimum wage, putting in real estate data into the computer. Then my first legal job was working for Greenpeace as a canvasser, which I did for 2.5 years, which was a crash course in American middle class. I worked in a bookstore. I worked as a bike messenger. I worked in a kitchen of a fast food restaurant. I worked as an ESL teacher. I worked in several bookstores. And then I was a graduate student. And now I'm a professional writer.
In one of your stories, the character talks about, this is a character in Bosnia, in Sarajevo, and he talks about how, you know, when you walk from point A to point B in Sarajevo, you risk getting killed by a sniper. But if you make it to point B, then you're momentarily thrilled to be alive, even though you're living under siege. So one of the things, you weren't living in that world of danger, but you weren't also getting that kind of surge of joy to be alive.
Right. A lot of friends of mine talked about this kind of adrenaline rush that they would have in Sarajevo, because for the very fact of being able to survive, which was also, you know, would be followed by this horrible, horrible depression. It's not even the word. It sounds too mild. The horrible fear and, you know, the endless darkness that they were facing, it seemed to them, and not to mention the physical obstacles like the lack of food and lack of movement and lack of healthcare and all kinds of lacks. But this adrenaline rush made a lot of people in Sarajevo, particularly artists, do incredible things, and they were really excited to be alive in that city at that time, as strange as it sounds, whereas I was not particularly excited to be alive in the United States at that time, although I was in a much better position, obviously.
There's a passage in your new collection, The Question of Bruno, that I'd like you to read. And this is about a character who, like you, has come to the United States from Bosnia, and he's working at a restaurant. Would you introduce this passage for us, set the context for us?
Well, my character, Josef Pronek, who had decided to stay in the United States because of the war in Bosnia, has to find a job. And so he goes out and finds a job in a bakery that serves sandwiches of all kinds. His duty is described as the kitchen help. So he's at work at this moment. He was listlessly piling up trays on the top of the bin when a man in a grass-green shirt with a golfer shade swinging a golf club in its coronary area said, "Young man, would you please come here?" Pronek obediently walked to the man's table and stood there as vague hatred brewed in his muscles. The man had nicely combed blonde hair, and Pronek could see the immaculate line disappearing into the pate. The man pointed at the croissant on his plate. There was a monstrous golden seal ring on his pinky, and he said, "I wanted romaine lettuce on my turkey Dijon. Excuse me, but this is not romaine lettuce. This is iceberg lettuce. What do you have to say about that?" Pronek was about to go and tell the sandwich person about the problem, but then, abruptly overwhelmed with the desire not to be there at the moment, said, "Nothing." "I'd like my turkey Dijon with romaine lettuce, please," the man said. "What's the difference?" Pronek said. "Excuse me?" The man raised his voice, his double chin doubly corrugated in disbelief. "Romaine lettuce, iceberg lettuce, what's the difference?" Pronek said, with a sudden vision of stuffing the lettuce leaf into the man's mouth. "May I talk to someone who can speak English, please?" the man said, and pushed his tray away with resolve as the croissant shuddered and slid to the edge of the plate. Pronek felt pain climbing up his calves, passing his pelvis to settle in his stomach as a cramp. He wanted to say something clever that would smash the man, but could not think of any English words that could convey the magnitude of the absurdity other than romaine lettuce, iceberg lettuce, what difference? He kept mumbling it to himself, like a magic word that would make him fly, and wobbled away in a vain hope that the man might just give it up. But the man naturally did not give it up, for he demanded, and rightly so, full and responsible service for his hard-earned money.
I'm wondering if when you were working, before you had really brushed up on your English, people often assumed that you were stupid because you didn't speak the language well.
That is true. And in fact, when I taught English as a second language, I would have students, most of my students for one reason or another were Russian Jews or Jews from the former Soviet Union. And some of them were literally rocket scientists. Some of them were inventors, and they would design things and gadgets for cars that would be pursued by General Motors. But they would be on level two and could not figure out the plural of ox. They would say oxes rather than oxen, as if they would, you know, encounter a herd of oxen on the streets of Chicago any time. So they needed to know the plural. And this kind of condescension, it is so frequent and so insulting to people who have had full lives and very complicated lives. And I would tell my students that some of them would be so ashamed of their accent that they would decide, which is impossible, to learn the English and then start speaking it. They wanted to be assimilated. They wanted to work on their accents. Until very recently, I was working at the Literacy Center in Chicago, where most of the learners were, you know, non-native speakers. And more than a half of them would come in, and when we would ask them what is it that they wanted to work on first, they would say speaking, that is the accent. They wanted to have the accent gone.
How did you go about learning the language? You already knew some of it when you decided to stay, but not enough to really write. How did you go about learning pronunciations and the words themselves?
Well, I never really worked on my accent. I worked as a canvasser for Greenpeace, so I had to talk a lot and without having any time to be self-conscious. And I didn't.
So you're going door to door canvassing people for,
yes,
for Greenpeace?
Yes. So, I never worried about my accent. But the other good thing about canvassing was that you pick up on, you know, the colloquial idiomatic things, which are not hard to pick up on. So there was one way of learning, just talking a lot and being involved in exchanges with people. But also I read obsessively at the beginning. I still do read a lot, obviously, but I read when I wasn't working. I read. That's what I did. I read and worked and ate and slept. And I would make lists of words that I did not understand and then look them up in the dictionary. I had the Advanced Learner Oxford Dictionary, or the Oxford Dictionary for an Advanced Learner, it was called. And so I would look up these words. Some of them I have to look up 10, 12 times because I understood them in a sense that I could use them as I write, that is, with all the little implications and the aura around the world, the word, and so on. And I guess it sounds, you know, complicated now, but whatever language you write in, you learn to write in that language, and you learn the language that you use to write by reading. This happens to any writer in any language at any time, except I had to do it, you know, quickly.
There's a character in one of your stories who's walking down what's called the Magnificent Mile in Chicago, and he finds himself thinking of the film The Magnificent Seven. I'm wondering if you made any bizarre word associations, because there were words that you had known for a long time in English back from your days in Sarajevo, and now you're encountering them while actually trying to learn the English language.
Well, it's interesting that you put it that way. I wasn't aware of that at the time, but it seems to me that what you're saying is true. The Magnificent Seven, I mean, the word magnificent was always, and it still is, as you were talking, I understood that, was always related to this film, The Magnificent Seven. It's Yul Brynner and other guys.
Steve McQueen.
Steve McQueen, yes. But yeah, it is. I picked up some words. The way, I guess, you get words if you're not in an English-speaking country is you get them in strange streams, you know, from odd places, because you're not aware of the context that they're attached to. They just come to you, in a sense. And, you know, I watched American movies, which were not dubbed, but subtitled, and also I listened to, you know, pop music that had English lyrics, and I knew all these words, but I was not always aware how exactly they function.
Did you find that when you started writing in English, that you started writing about different subjects or writing in a stylistically different way than you did when you were in Bosnia?
I did, indeed. When I was in Bosnia, I wrote this kind of minimalistic stories, which were really a symptom of helplessness and the lack of imagination that will allow me to imagine the magnitude of evil that was to come. So, but I am a different writer in English, absolutely. But it's also, I'm a different person, and this change, the switch from the language, my previous language to this language, was related to my, you know, transformation as a person. I still do write in Bosnian, however. I write for a magazine in Sarajevo called Dani. I write a biweekly column in Bosnian.
My guest is Alexander Heyman. His new collection of short stories is called The Question of Bruno. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Alexander Heyman. He's a Bosnian writer who has lived in the U.S. since shortly before the siege of Sarajevo. Do you have friends or family who stayed in Sarajevo and lived in Bosnia throughout the siege and were really transformed by it and are really, as far as you can tell, like different people now?
I do have friends. One of my best friends he spent 3.5 years in the Bosnian army, and it was not easy for him because his ethnicity was not exactly good for being in the Bosnian army, let's say. But he's not a transformed person. He has changed, but changed in ways that I could anticipate knowing him so well. And so we had to do some catching up. But other than that, it wasn't a spectacular transformation. There were people who were my friends before the war, and then they chose their nation over their neighbors, which kind of ended our friendship. And so I don't know the exact ways in which they changed, but they became nationalistic and, bloodthirsty in some ways.
Now, I read that one of your Shakespeare teachers ended up in the Milosevic government, and you saw him on TV.
Well, I saw him everywhere because he wasn't in the Milosevic government. He was in the Bosnian Serb government, which was controlled by Milosevic, strictly speaking. He was my professor in college. He didn't. He taught poetry and criticism and all kinds of things. He was well versed in Shakespeare, and he spoke English fluently. He taught in Champaign at the University of Illinois at some point, because University of Illinois at Champaign has a huge Slavic department. And he was a rather brilliant man. I liked him as a teacher very much. I graduated in 1990, and in 1991, he joined the Serbian Nationalist Party. And I worked at the magazine at the time. I would go to news conference where he would be along, and the conference would be held by Radovan Karadzic, who was way on the top of the list of war criminals in former Yugoslavia. And so after the conference, I would go and greet him, and he would tell me things like, you should stay out of this, you should stick to literature. And then in 92 and 93, he became obviously heavily involved in the crimes committed in Bosnia. And the word has it, and I'm not sure this is exactly true, that he was kind of the instigator of the burning of the library in Sarajevo, the infamous burning of the library with a lot of books, which is ironic since he was a literature professor. And he, publicly denied the existence of camps and rape and such. He was kind of a Rosenberg-like war criminal. He would have been had he not shot himself. He wasn't directly involved in military operations, I don't think, but he was, being a soft-spoken, English-speaking intellectual. He was involved with foreign journalists and was a kind of a propaganda man, in a sense. He shot himself in 1995, I believe. Took two shots.
When you were studying with him, did you know much about his politics, and did your knowledge of his politics interfere with your taking him seriously as a professor of Shakespeare?
I did not know his politics, and the politics were invisible. And the way he taught literature is in a kind of a new critical tradition, the way he was taught in this country for a long time until, at least until the feminist revolution, let's say, which, assumes that the work of art is a thing unto itself, that the only thing that you need to understand is how the internal structure of a poem or a novel, that things outside of it do not matter. So, and his politics, it was not visible at the time. I mean, he would not say anything in the class. And then we busied ourselves with, analyzing poems and, finding rhymes and decoding images and all this. So his politics, it was completely invisible. But then I realized later on that it was still political, this kind of attitude towards literature, in which it is just this thing that exists outside of the realm of general human experience, outside of politics or, everyday practices. This realm where we go when we want to be excited and, reach the divine realms and all this neo-romantic stuff. And I realized that while I was busying myself analyzing poems, he was plotting a crime. And I've, felt terribly guilty for not being conscious enough, although I was very young at the time, so I guess I kind of eventually forgave myself. But I then busily tried to detect the moment or the moments when his politics were his genocidal proclivities, let's say, were detectable. And so I reread a lot of books that he taught and a lot of poems and then some news and completely changed the way I thought about literature.
It changed the way you thought about literature?
Yes. I mean, thinking about it. Thinking about what his role was in all that. I suddenly realized that literature at one level or another is always political and it always implies a political attitude. And it's not this thing outside of all that, but in a sense in the center of all that.
You said that a new language developed in Bosnia during the war. And this was a period when you weren't there to hear any new expressions. What were you able to glean about new expressions?
Well, if, you know, a language is always related to the experience of the people who speak it, then the war was a different experience, and it transformed the language in many ways. You know, the words, the military words. I translated the works, some of the writing of my friend and arguably the greatest living Bosnian writer, Semezin Mehmedinović. His book is Sarajevo Blues. I translated it into English because largely I wanted to show it to some people. It's the best book written about the war and stuff. And I had some of the words, I had to call up my friends who were, you know, under siege, who were in the war, and ask them, what is this? The words may be for, you know, some kind of piece of military equipment, or where there was a word for a martyr fighter in the Bosnian army, and, you know, a large number of other words. The word for, which is incredibly beautiful to me in a strange way, the word for the point of impact of a shell on the street, which is a little crater with rays around it, the word for that became the word that is, I mean, the word for rose, a flower. And, you know, I came upon that word and suddenly it was confusing to me. I did not know what it was until I saw it when I went back to Sarajevo. And so my experience was entirely different here from the experience of people in Sarajevo. And I had no words in Bosnian to describe this experience here. And the words in Bosnian that I knew were kind of inadequate to describe the experience that was, or to understand the experience of the people in Sarajevo and Bosnia.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Alexander Heyman's new collection of short stories is called The Question of Bruno. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Random House Incorporated, Delacorte Books Division, publisher of Civil Warriors, The Legal Siege on the Tobacco Industry by Dan Ziegart. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk to political reporter Wayne Barrett about his new investigative biography of Rudolph Giuliani, the mayor of New York City. Giuliani recently dropped out of the U.S. Senate race after being diagnosed with prostate cancer. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Rudolph Giuliani, the controversial mayor of New York, was being closely watched by political reporters around the country when he was running for the U.S. Senate opposite Hillary Clinton. But he dropped out of the race in the spring, announcing that he had prostate cancer and that he was separating from his wife. My guest, Wayne Barrett, has written a new investigative biography of him. Barrett is senior editor at The Village Voice and has covered Giuliani for over 20 years. Giuliani is a former federal prosecutor who made his name going after the mafia and white-collar criminals. He was the hero of Barrett's 1989 book, City for Sale. But Giuliani isn't depicted as a hero in the new biography. Barrett portrays him as a politician who steals credit for successes he isn't responsible for and dodges blame for problems he helped create. I asked Barrett when his opinion of Giuliani changed.
I would say that, there were some changes in both campaigns when he ran in 89 and 93. I thought particularly he ran to the right when he ran in 93 against the then incumbent mayor, David Dinkins. And I was troubled by many of the racial aspects of the 1993 campaign. But really, I think the point at which Rudy changed in a fundamental way was after he endorsed Mario Cuomo in 94, George Pataki won, Newt Gingrich won control of the Congress, the rise of the right within his own party, with him having made this misstep endorsing this liberal Democratic governor. And it was at that point in late 94 and in early 95 that we saw an enormous ideological shift on Giuliani's part. I think it continues to this day. But that would be the point at which I felt that he had changed his politics in such a fundamental way, and his welfare policies and many of his anti-poor policies and anti-black policies began to be very much a prominent part of his administration.
Did you feel like he underwent this ideological change to ingratiate himself to the Republicans who he had alienated by supporting the Democrat Mario Cuomo, or did you feel it was a genuine political change that he underwent?
I don't think any of his political ideology is genuine. This is a man who became a registered Republican to get a job in the Reagan administration when he was appointed Associate Attorney General. He is extraordinarily flexible and non-ideological. As a person, that's the way I've known him. I think that's the way I write about him. He adapted to what he saw as the change within the country and within the party, and he did an abrupt 180-degree turn. He can do that on a dime.
Now, you say that there's little question that New York City became a better place to live on Giuliani's watch. What improved in New York?
Well, certainly we have safer streets. Certainly we have cleaner streets. I point out particularly the sanitation department, I think, was the strongest department of his administration in the early years and dramatically improved productivity on the streets of New York. He has somewhat of an overblown reputation, which I think he has hyped on the crime front, but there's no question but that crime has been reduced here, as it has been reduced in most major cities in the country, and to a certain degree just by his appointment of Bill Bratton, the police commissioner of the first 2 years of his administration. He certainly should get credit for appointing Bratton, who did a number of things that did have some impact.
Now, you think that Giuliani took credit for many things that he wasn't responsible for. One big example is the renovation of Times Square. Times Square has gone from a kind of, you know, seedy block to now it's got like the Disney stores and other mega stores, big tourist attraction now. In what way do you think he took credit for something that he wasn't responsible for?
Well, you know, he's the first mayor to ever push the button on New Year's Eve. Mayors didn't do that. He insinuated himself into that spot very early in his administration. And I think he kind of merged, particularly when he pushed the button on a new millennium. There's every year when that happens, there are news stories about the resurgence of Times Square. And every year he has identified himself in the public consciousness with that resurgence. In fact, if you cite the Disney deal, for an example, which I think was a pivotal deal, that was all negotiated by the Dinkins administration. In fact, crime went down 27% in Times Square in the final year of the Dinkins administration. Street cleanliness improved dramatically in the final year of the Dinkins administration in Times Square. So even if you look at porn shops, where he did introduce legislation which ultimately passed, was tested in the courts, to try to reduce the number of porn shops in the Times Square area. By the time that law went into effect, the number of porn shops had already declined from 140 to 21. What produced the decline was the condemnation of those properties by the state and the city, and that was put together really under the Koch and Cuomo administrations. And this irony was that I decided to write this as the opening chapter, thinking that this would be a balanced chapter, that I would have pluses and minuses, that I would have things that I could say, well, this Rudy did this, and this is, I thought it was a metaphor for his government. It turned out it was a metaphor for taking credit, which he is an expert at doing, for things he had virtually nothing to do with.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Wayne Barrett. He's the author of the new book, Rudy, an investigative biography of Rudolph Giuliani. And Wayne Barrett is senior editor at The Village Voice, where he's been covering politics for 22 years. Rudolph Giuliani takes some of the credit for crime having dropped in New York during the years that he's been mayor. What are some of the statistics, and how much of the credit do you think Giuliani deserves for that?
Well, you know, I quote Mike Julian, who was a very high-level police commander under both Dinkins and Giuliani. And he tells the tale about how, if you asked the average New Yorker what were the five things that Rudy Giuliani did, one of them would be he got rid of the squeegees were the guys that washed your windshield when you didn't want them to wash your windshield, and seemed to intimidate some drivers in the process of doing it at many street corners, pivotal street corners, well-trafficked street corners, rather, in New York. And it turns out, Mike Julian says, we got rid of every squeegee before Rudy Giuliani took office, and that he saw Rudy Giuliani give a speech in which he laid claim to this, and Christine Latigano was press secretary. Rudy's press secretary was there. So Julian goes up and explains to Christine, shows her the numbers, talks with her about this, is assured that he won't do this again. Of course, he's continued to do it. I cite that as sort of an example. Now, the thing that propelled Giuliani's election in 1993 more than any other factor was what the widespread perception that the murder rate had soared under David Dinkins, soared and topped 2,000 for the first time in the history of the city. There was no question but that there were more than 2,000 murders a year in the first two Dinkins years, and that the murder rate was very high. But the fact is that the murder rate had been artificially lowered in the years prior to David Dinkins taking office. There was no great upsurge in the murder rate in the Dinkins years, and the perception of that upsurge was key to Giuliani's election. He had nothing to do with the manipulation of the figures prior to taking office, but what actually happened was that during the Koch administration, and even going back to the Beam administration and even to the Lindsay administration, the number of undetermined external deaths was allowed to grow dramatically in New York, atypical of anywhere around the country. And these are deaths where the medical examiner cannot determine if they're homicide or if they're an accident. And that number grew to 720 in the final year of the Koch administration. It actually averaged throughout the 80s somewhere between 700 and 800. This was a figure that created the possibility of diluting the murder rate. And when Charles Hirsch, the new medical examiner, took office in 1989, he instituted new policies, hired 28 new assistant medical examiners, and they dramatically, in Dinkins's first year, reduced the number of undetermined external deaths, and this resulted in a dramatic increase in the number of murders. That's why everyone believed throughout the Dinkins administration that we suddenly had a dramatic turn in the murder rate.
Although the crime statistics look improved under the Giuliani administration, There were some really horrible police brutality cases that became big national stories. For example, Amadou Diallo, a West African man, took 19 bullets from four cops while he reached for his wallet, which the cops thought might be a gun. Abner Louima, a Haitian man, was sodomized with a stick in a police precinct. Anthony Baez, a Puerto Rican man, was choked to death by a cop. A few weeks ago, women were attacked in New York by groups of men in Central Park, and cops stood by as the women screamed for help. What do you think Giuliani's reaction to these police brutality cases have been? The last case wasn't a brutality case. It was a standing by case.
Well, he's other than in the Abner Louima case, which occurred when he was running for re-election in 1997, when he acted promptly to suspend the police officers that were involved, and he took dramatic steps. Those are the kinds of steps he should have done in many other instances, but he clearly did this for political purposes because that case occurred really close to the election in 1997. He appointed a task force, and then after he was reelected, he derided the task force's findings, and I think that really exposed just how political his actions were in 1997. But he did appear to deal with that case promptly and appropriately. In every other instance, he has been abysmal in the handling of these cases. I find the two cases that disturb me the most are two young men who were not killed, Michael Jones and Dante Johnson, one in Brooklyn and one in the Bronx, both 16 years old, lying in critical condition in their hospital beds when he went public and derided their parents for letting them be out. One was out at 2 o'clock in the morning and one was out at 12:30 at night. And said, what kind of parents are they to let their kids be out at night? These were kids who were not in any way involved in any criminal activity. The police shootings of them were clearly mistakes. And instead of expressing some sympathy for either the young man or their families, he attacked their families while they sat in critical condition. This is the kind of things that he has done that I think have poisoned in a way that's unprecedented in the city, the relationship that he has as mayor with the black community.
My guest is Wayne Barrett, author of a new biography of New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Wayne Barrett, author of a new investigative biography of New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. Politicians are always trying to place pressure on their opponents' vulnerabilities. Rudy Giuliani commissioned a vulnerability study about himself so that he and his aides could examine all of Giuliani's weaknesses and then figure out how to defend himself against attacks on those weaknesses. You managed to get access to this vulnerability study that Giuliani commissioned in 1993 during his mayoral run. What was in the study?
Well, it's about 5 inches thick. Mm. And two researchers did it and worked on it for many months. The study reviews Rudy's entire public and his public career and personal life prior to 1993. The study is published in April of 93. And Rudy Giuliani believed that he had had all copies of it destroyed. The day he received it, he sent an aide to the desk of the two research assistants, and the aide killed it on the hard drive of both of their computers, took the disks, and confiscated what he thought were the only four copies that were made of it. Though the theory of a vulnerability study is you look at the weaknesses and then you come up with strategies to counteract it, and certainly the vulnerability study had strategies that it recommended to counteract all of the weaknesses and vulnerabilities that it described, none of those strategies were ever implemented or discussed because Rudy was so upset about the tenor of the report itself, that he just wanted a deep sixth. But just to give you an example, and there, you know, there are sections in there about his ruthlessness. There are sections, if you remember, that he spearheaded a rally of police officers outside of City Hall at the time of the Dinkins administration that turned into a riot with cops overturning everything. And Giuliani spoke there, and he used expletives several times to denounce Dinkins, and he was roundly condemned for that, but never was he condemned more for it than in his own vulnerability study. The chapter is called The Human Scream Machine, a description of the mayor himself by his own research director. So that's the kind of thing it exposed. It also looked into things on his personal life. For example, his first marriage to his second cousin, Regina Perugi, is described as evidence of a weirdness factor in his personal life. And then it discusses his, quotes, raucous social life, seeing other women during his first marriage.
Giuliani dropped out of the Senate race running against Hillary Clinton, saying that he had prostate cancer and that he was separating from his wife. But it turned out he hadn't told his wife that yet. Then his wife, Donna Hanover, held a press conference of her own in which she announced that she hadn't been part of his public life for several years because of another woman who turned out to be his former press secretary. Did she know about the affair that he was having at that time with the woman he's still with, Judith Nathan?
She apparently learned about that very late. That's at least what she says. I really can't get into her head, but she has said that she learned about that very late. You know, he brought her to the Inner Circle. The Inner Circle is this annual event that all of the press corps in New York, it's a stage show. The reporters perform, and then Rudy performs. And it's one of those big tux nights with everybody in the elite is there. And he brought her there and had her there at the table. And apparently, sometime after that, Donna Hanover learned about the relationship between Judith Nathan and Rudy.
The line between public and private life now for elected politicians and people running for office is so fuzzy now. I'm wondering if you had been reporting on Rudolph Giuliani's private life, if you had inside information about Judith Nathan or about the woman who had been his lover before that, who was a member of his administration, if you knew about it and if you thought you should write about it or not.
It's a very complex question. I think it's different for a reporter than it is for a biographer. I'm a biographer wearing that hat today.
Yeah.
And certainly I think someone's private life, I think we expect to read some things about that in a biography, and I think it would be ridiculous to suggest that someone's romantic life was irrelevant to a biography. But on the other hand, I knew about Judith Nathan. I learned about her, in November of 1999, and the New York Post did a story maybe two or three months ago. It was a front-page story in a Saturday Post saying that the reason why Rudy revealed the relationship with Judith Nathan was that he knew I knew about her. I have no idea. They cited blind City Hall sources as saying this. I have no idea if that's the case. It certainly is true that I knew about her. I had not yet made up my mind to write about her. I was saving it for one of the final issues to deal with. Once he publicly announced it, I think it resolved all question, really, as to whether or not to write about it. Now, on the other hand, the relationship with Christine Latigano, I have absolutely no question in my mind that that is totally within the public purview. She became the second most powerful person in his government. She was a 28-year-old kid when she went to work for him. She had no governmental experience. And to have that kind of a relationship with a person that is raised to that level within your government who gets raises all the way up. She even got a $9,000 raise while she was on leave. And in the end, she was making over $141,000 as his communications director. And then his administration helped appoint her to her current position as the head of the tourist bureau. I have no question but that that is a totally legitimate story. There's no zone of privacy as far as I'm concerned. For the Latigano matter, the Nathan matter, I think she has nothing to do with his government. She's a personal friend of his. if he hadn't announced it, I think it's a very close call as to whether or not that's a legitimate story.
My guest is Wayne Barrett. He's the author of a new investigative biography of New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Wayne Barrett, author of an investigative biography of New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. You investigated the lives of some of Giuliani's family members, including Giuliani's father, who you say was an enforcer for a loan shark. And how is the loan shark connected to Giuliani?
The loan shark is Rudy's uncle, Leo DeVanzo. He's Helen Giuliani's brother. Helen is his mother.
And Giuliani's father also did time in Sing Sing for?
Armed robbery. He was also convicted of burglary at the age of 15. He was convicted of armed robbery at the age of 26.
What's the relevance of that information to Giuliani's career?
Well, I've never seen a politician in my life invoke his father more often than Rudy has. He's constantly talking about his father. And just a couple of months ago, he said he wouldn't be mayor were it not for Harold Giuliani. Harold Giuliani had a very important influence on his life. And again, I've never seen a biography that didn't look into the family roots of an individual, the individual that was being written about. And so I certainly think that Harold Giuliani is an enormously important character, and what he did and the fact that he did it all through Rudy's young life. He was working in this mob bar. He was an enforcer and a loan shark and a gambling operation. That's what put the bread on Rudy's table. And cousins younger than Rudy knew that the bar was that kind of operation. They told me that on the record. I quote one cousin who's several years younger than Rudy is saying that Uncle Leo was mafiosa. And, you know, there's a mafia wing to the family. Rudy has unimpeachable credentials as a mafia fighter. I don't think it says anything about that. In fact, maybe this experience helped drive him, but there's certainly no question in my mind that this criminal history, Rudy has absolutely no empathy, no sympathy for anybody who comes into contact with the criminal justice system, apparently except members of his own family. He treats fare beaters as scoundrels, and I think that's really one of the interesting insights in him. You would think that this personal history, this family history that he's had, would open him to the idea that life is a little more complex than that. He's still saying, Rudy is, that his father was the most honest man he ever knew. Well, if his father was the most honest man he ever knew when he did a year and a half in Sing Sing, maybe that should be instructive to Rudy about the complexity of life, that there's a few grays in there. It's not all black and white. Instead, he's had precisely the opposite attitude. So I think there are many ways in which it's very relevant. Rudy obviously has transcended the cesspool that some members of his family lived in, and he has been an enormously effective prosecutor of the mob.
Mm-hmm. Now, Giuliani also had five uncles who were cops, and that might have influenced his thinking, too.
He had one uncle that was a cop very briefly, but four who were cops for most of their adult lives. Mm-hmm. One of those cops was also involved with the bar. In fact, the bar was in the name of one of the uncles who was a cop, and this uncle who was a cop was also busted on gambling-related charges. So, but the rest of the cops in the family were very outstanding individuals, as best as I could determine, and he had four cousins who were cops, one of whom was killed in the line of duty. So certainly he has a long police tradition in his family. That's one of the reasons he says he understands the psyche of the police department better than any other mayor.
Is there something personal going on in this book, too? You used to really admire Giuliani. As you say, he was the hero of your first book, City for Sale. Then you really felt betrayed by the way he handled himself as mayor and handled himself as a campaigner. You felt betrayed, I think, by his change of politics. So is there something personal between you and him?
Well, I wouldn't use the word betrayed. I don't think I'd use the word disappointed. I've been, there's no question but that I've covered him, known him since 1979. I've been dismayed and disappointed by his race policies, by the ethics of this administration. I'm certainly a human being, and I approached him as a human being, and I write passionately about issues, and I think you see that in there. But I don't feel some deep personal animus towards him or anything like that.
You were pretty close to Giuliani for a while.
I was, yes.
Are you afraid to get close to people who are in politics now?
Well, I was close to him when he was a prosecutor. Mm-hmm. I had many, many meals with him, many, many social moments with him while he was a federal prosecutor. I never had another meal with him the day he left the United States Attorney's Office. When he became a politician, I don't buddy up with politicians.
Wayne Barrett is the author of Rudy, an investigative biography of Rudolph Giuliani. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Sherrock. Our engineer is Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications. BEA.com. And from Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of After the Ecstasy, The Laundry, How the Heart Grows Wise on the Spiritual Path by Jack Kornfield. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with two doctors about prescription medicines, the high costs, the problems for the elderly who have no insurance coverage for their medicines, dealing with side effects when you're taking several medicines, drug advertising on TV, and more. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.